experiments from Weerarotney and Manga in the late 90s, and they performed laboratory experiments with temperature-dependent viscosity. So the working fluid here was strongly temperature-dependent, and they varied also the Rayleigh number. And they observed a transition from steady to unsteady flow at a Rayleigh number around 10 to the 5, not particularly strongly dependent on the viscosity ratio. So this is a large Rayleigh number. Yeah, question?
Hi, what do you exactly mean by steady versus plume-dominated flow?
Okay, so let's just go through this. So steady means not changing with respect to time. So velocities and temperature remain unchanged once the system reaches a steady state. Unsteady means that those quantities, any of the variables in the simulation, are changing. So temperature could be changing, heat flux is changing, velocities are changing. So, and then plume dominated was a different convective regime that they observed in the laboratory experiments, in which they observed the formation of plumes. So, what I wanted to say is there a characteristic Rayleigh number for Earth is somewhere towards the right side of this plot. We could argue about how exactly to define a Rayleigh number for the Earth because of depth-dependent viscosity and the contributions of both internal heating and basal heating. But a representative Rayleigh number for Earth's mantle might be somewhere in this range, 10 to the 6 to 10 to the 7, possibly a little bit higher. And it's also something that can change over time. So as the Earth cools, convective vigor will decrease, and you could actually transition from an unsteady regime into a steady regime. We know from the rock record, actually, that the configuration of plate boundaries over time has changed. So these are paleogeographic reconstructions from a recent paper by Kara Matthews and others, published in 2016. And I'm showing you here just the configuration of continents and plate boundaries 250 million years ago on the right and at present on the left. And in particular, I'd like you to pay attention to the configuration of subduction zones or convergent plate boundaries, indicated in purple here. I know it's a little bit difficult to see. Purple over here and purple here and a more complex geometry of purple subduction zones here on the western margin of the Panthalassa Ocean 250 million years ago. So there's been some net rearrangement in the configuration of plate boundaries, and the locations of convergence at the surface will correspond to locations of mantle downwelling in the upper mantle, and the configuration of spreading centers, shown in blue, will correspond to the locations of mantle upwelling. So these locations of upwelling and downwelling have changed over geologic time, and presumably on much longer timescales than shown here, they may have changed more profoundly. So the surface motions are strongly time-dependent, with the locations of upwellings and downwellings changing. And this could have actually very significant consequences for the survival of heterogeneities within the mantle. I also want to say briefly that from laboratory numerical experiments, we expect multiple different modes of surface deformation, which we characterize in different tectonic regimes. So shown here actually are two different convective regimes from a paper by Moraisi and Solomatov in 1998. And on the left is a stagnant lid regime, and on the right is a mobile lid regime. The difference is very straightforward. In the stagnant lid regime, the lithosphere is immobile. It's fixed over time. It's not deforming internally. In the mobile lid regime, the lithosphere moves, and its characteristic velocity is comparable to the characteristic velocities of the convecting interior of the convection cell here. And in numerical geodynamic models, to obtain this kind of mobile lid regime, which is more representative of the style of tectonic deformation at Earth's surface, it's generally necessary to introduce some kind of weakening behavior. Because if we consider the contribution of temperature dependence alone to viscosity, we expect the cold surface boundary layer to be very, very viscous and strong, and therefore for the planet to be in a stagnant Lind regime. And it's by introducing some kind of weakening, here represented using a yield stress that includes both a constant term, tau naught, this is like a cohesion, and also a depth-dependent term, something that depends on the dimensionless depth here, z prime. The lithosphere is weakened, and it's able to fail and be recycled back into the mantle. So in these two calculations, here the Rayleigh number is 10 to the 7. The Rayleigh number is the same in both calculations, and the overall viscosity contrast is the same. But there are different values of this first parameter in the yielding law, tau naught. And you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I dimensionalized these and came up with values here for C naught around 120 megapascals, and here around 12 megapascals. So to get this type of tectonic regime where the surface is mobile and recycled back into the convecting interior, we have to introduce actually a very low value of this effective yield stress. So this tells us that this type of deformation can really only occur when we have very weak plate boundaries.
Max, just a quick question. What's the difference between left and right subpanels?
The left and the right subpanels. Yeah, that's a good question. My recollection here is that this is, Louis, you can correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, I'll correct you. Yeah.
These are a stream function?
Yeah,
right?
stream lines are there, and the temperature, I guess, was shaded.
Yes.
And then the one on the right, I think, is the stress invariant.
I was trying to remember if it's stress invariant or strain rate.
It must be stress, because it's high in the stagnant lid, right? So
okay.
I think it's stress.
Thank you very much. Okay. I'll similarly refer your questions about the next slide to Diogo, who sent me this movie. And this is just to illustrate for those who are unfamiliar with these concepts. Time-dependent convection with a mobile lid versus a stagnant lid. So this is from Diogo Lorenzo. And these are convection calculations that are performed in the spherical annulus. And the model on the left is identical to the model on the right, except for the presence of a lower yield stress. So here there's a lower value of the yield stress. On the right, there's no yielding behavior. And you can see that there's kind of time-dependent recycling of the cold upper thermal boundary layer back into the convecting interior. And that affects the dynamics of the mantle at all depths. It could also have very significant geochemical implications because here you're recycling presumably a basaltic crust back into the interior and introducing heterogeneity, whereas here you would generally predict that there may not be any melting at all if the stagnant lid is thick enough, and so any heterogeneity is not being recycled back into the interior of the planet. I just want to emphasize that this is actually convecting. It's very difficult to see because the absolute temperature is plotted here rather than the deviation from temperature at a given depth. But yes, this is actually a convecting interior, and where you can see the gradational color change is the stagnant conductive lid.
Did it get hotter over time?
Did it get hotter over time? We can watch the movie again and think about that. And yeah, it did. So the insulating lid doesn't transfer heat very effectively, and so there's an evolution of the mantle internal temperature. Yeah, okay, so this is just taken from some work that Diogo did that was largely about the influence of melting and crustal production on mantle evolution. And we're not going to go down that road right now, but it is very interesting, and I encourage you to check out his paper. So this is from the same work, actually, and this is a regime diagram. It's actually a regime diagram that's in dimensional quantities, which for some people are easier to think about. But on the horizontal axis is the assumed value of the yield stress, and on the vertical axis is actually the initial potential temperature, which affects the tectonic regime that these calculations end up in. And you can see the division between a mobile lid tectonic regime on the left and a stagnant lid regime on the right. The quantity that's actually being contoured here is a mobility, which is just a ratio of the velocities of the surface relative to the velocities of the interior. So a larger value just means that the surface is moving at a larger fraction of the velocity of the interior. So the key takeaway message here is that in order to produce a more Earth-like tectonic regime, you have to appeal generally to a relatively low value of the yield stress. They find some ways out of this, actually, when they include melting and crustal production. I'm not going to talk about that at all. But you have to assume a rather low value of the yield stress. Other lines of evidence suggest that the yield stress of intact plates on Earth is significantly higher. And this is one of the classic long-standing problems, I think, in geodynamics, that plate boundaries are weak, while intact interiors of oceanic plates are relatively strong. So this is work from Zhang and Watts, a paper in JGR. And what they're looking at here is the combined viscous and elastic response of the Pacific plate to the seamount loading of Hawaii. So this is a cartoon of Hawaii, the Big Island, loading the plate. They have a much more detailed model for how these lavas accumulate on top of the Pacific plate over time. But you can just do a back of the envelope calculation. Calculate, well, this is like the formula for the volume of a triangle of rotation, so a cone. You can multiply that by a density and divide it by the basal surface area of this same cone. And you'll come up with a value of the load on the Pacific plate on the order of 150 megapascals. So on the order of 5 times larger than the assumed strength of the lithosphere in the previous calculations that I just showed you. So I wanted to point out that the intact interiors of oceanic plates can support very large loads. And they include actually quite a detailed model where they try to estimate the flexural response of the Pacific plate, flexural profiles shown here in the upper left panel, and also the mechanical properties of the lithosphere and the upper mantle in these models. And they estimate that the maximum lithospheric stresses beneath Hawaii are, as you might expect, on the order of 100 to 200 megapascal in order to support these surface loads. So there is this discrepancy in the values of strength that you have to assume to produce mobile lid tectonics in geodynamic models, and the kinds of loads that we know that the plates can support based on topography. Question?
So is this has something to do with the fact that the lithosphere below Hawaii is now old and dry versus maybe early lithosphere that was under the effect of water, more water in the mantle in the early Earth?
I'm not sure, actually.
But we can agree that all lithosphere is dry and rigid.
Sure.
Okay.
I have a related question. My related question is, what if you were to repeat this analysis in a region that is not the middle of a oceanic plate? I mean, there are oceanic islands that are closer to transform faults or to spreading centers or to subduction zones or whatever.
So I guess the reason why we've done this so extensively for Hawaii, and by we I mean the geodynamics community, is that Hawaii is obviously the largest load, right? It's very productive, and it's also relatively well characterized, right, through seismic reflection profiles from which these kinds of flexural profiles are estimated. So I'm not sure actually how the loads at other seamounts compare with Hawaiian loading. Maybe somebody else in the room can comment on this. Bruce?
I mean, the assumption here is that all lithosphere is created equal and it doesn't depend on, for example, its history and other things. And these are probably important factors in these sorts of questions.
Yeah, of course. And so actually, if you try to estimate the strength of the plate boundaries, you'll find that they're very, very weak. So while simultaneously, the strength of the Pacific plate beneath Hawaii is large.
Just the only comment I would make is that yield stress here is being used to capture a whole range of deformation processes. And what deformation may be happening under Hawaii, the type of deformation that's occurring is probably not the same as what's happening in a subduction zone. So you actually have faulting and fracturing of the plate as it bends in a subduction zone, which affects its effective strength, which we try to capture with a yield strength in these global long-term models. And
yes.
So the yield stress is it's a catch-all for a lot of different mechanisms. So you try not to read too much into it. It can vary for a lot of different reasons.
Yes, thank you, Magali. That's a really good comment.
I just want to add a comment. One way to think about all lithosphere or the middle of the lithosphere being strong is the fact that the Earth isn't littered with subduction zones, right? There are basically no intraoceanic subduction zones, give or take a few. Right. And that means, but yet, the oceanic lithosphere is denser than the mantle underneath by maybe 25, 30 million years. So that tells you something about strength.
Is that another question, or?
No, thank you.
Okay, thanks, Carolina. So, that said, I'd like to move on and talk a little bit about what happens to mantle mixing when you introduce plate-like flow. And one of the fascinating consequences of introducing plates on the surface is the emergence of some component of toroidal motion. And toroidal motion just means any kind of shearing in the plane of the surface. It's in contrast to poloidal motion, which is divergence or convergence at the surface. And so toroidal motion is associated with oceanic transforms and also strike-slip plate boundaries like the San Andreas Fault. Convergent and divergent motion is associated with spreading centers and subduction zones. And Earth has both toroidal and poloidal motion at the surface, and it's expected that then the mantle has both toroidal and poloidal flow. It's worth mentioning briefly that for purely buoyancy-driven flow, in the absence of any lateral variations in viscosity, you don't generate any toroidal motion. So it's a consequence of the presence of lateral variations in viscosity, presumably both within the mantle and also within the weak plate boundaries that give rise to toroidal motion. And toroidal motion is interesting because it can cause things to be stirred more effectively into the mantle. And that was illustrated really nicely in a paper by Farashat and Ricard. So the ideas in this paper build upon what Carolina talked about in the last lecture. They did an analysis of Poincaré sections and also of the Lyapunov exponent, which is a measure of the local rate of stretching. And they just used very simple but physically insightful model setups here. In a three-dimensional cube, they introduced something analogous to a ridge offset by a transform fault. And in some of the calculations, they imposed just one-sided surface motion. In other calculations, they introduced symmetric spreading about this. But you can see that the surface velocity field will include both spreading and also shear across the transform fault. And this gets propagated into the interior of the model. So what's shown here is a slice across the middle of this domain. So the slice is just taken at the midplane of this box. And these are selected particle paths that pass through the midplane of the box. And what's shown here on the vertical axis are simulations with increasing contributions from the toroidal flow, so increasing shear at the surface. And as you increase the amount of shear at the surface, you introduce more chaotic flow paths through the interior of the box. And presumably, this would cause, or not just presumably, this would cause particles in some regions of the flow field that are initially in contact with one another to be distributed over much larger distances. So it could increase the efficiency of mixing. Maybe easier to look at are these colorized plots of the finite time Lyapunov exponents for models that have plate-driven flow or have, plate-driven flow with this shear included, and models that have only poloidal flow, so no toroidal component. Question?
Yes. What is the Lyapunov exponent?
So, well, I'm sorry if it wasn't defined in the last lecture, but the Lyapunov exponent is a measure of the local rate of stretching. So you could think about two particles that start right next to each other at any position in your flow field. And what you're going to do is look at the rate at which those particles move apart. You could imagine that the rate at which that happens might depend on how those particles are oriented with respect to each other initially. And more mathematically, you can calculate the rate of stretching in each coordinate direction. And the Lyapunov exponent is a measure of the local rate at which these initially closely paired particles will disperse. So if you see a large value that's on the red end of this spectrum, that means that particles that started in a given location are going to end up far away from one another as time progresses. If you see a small value that's in the blue or purple end of the spectrum, that's telling you that these regions are relatively unmixed. This is called the finite time Lyapunov exponent because this type of analysis was developed to study flow fields that can be defined either infinitely in time or periodically. So it's very easy to calculate a true Lyapunov exponent for a flow field that's time periodic, and you can concoct a time periodic flow field in the lab or in a numerical simulation. Or a flow field that's truly steady. So this has been analyzed in quite a bit of detail, and I think Carolina talked about this a bit in her lecture. And Carolina also mentioned the concept of Lagrangian coherent structures, which are bounded by ridges in the Lyapunov exponent. So if you see a continuous kind of red band that can enclose a region within one of these Lyapunov exponent plots, that can tell you that it's the boundary of a region that remains coherent, so doesn't exchange mass with surrounding domains over the time scale of the experiment. So the takeaway message here is that in the models that include plate-driven flow and include more toroidal motion, you have much more extensive mixing, so these larger values of the Lyapunov exponent, than in the models that have purely poloidal flow, where you see much more of the domain that has low values of Lyapunov exponent. Laurent?
Okay, so I hear what you're saying there, and when you say more extensive, I can understand that. But somewhere, if I'm looking at those poloidal-only plots on the top, they are very pronounced region of red, which is a lot bigger. I mean, the red goes from 17.5 to 65.
Yeah, yeah.
So
yeah, this is a highly nonlinear color.
I can understand that, you know, you have a lot more greenish color, so maybe there's a lot more space that have relatively high Lyapunov exponent. I don't know what is a higher or low Lyapunov exponents anyway. But so I see more regions, but I see higher values potentially in the potential field. So
okay, so maybe you can build some intuition into what constitutes a high and low Lyapunov exponent during the tutorial on Thursday, when we're actually going to take some simple geodynamic models like the ones that you ran in the first geodynamics tutorial, and you'll be able to calculate these Lyapunov exponent fields. But I guess your question is, do these regions remain entirely unmixed?
No, it's more big red versus a lot of green.
Yeah, big red regions, so regions with highly divergent flow paths versus large regions that just have a moderate degree of mixing. I'm not sure, actually, how different the mixing dynamics in these two different regions are. I'll just make one more comment, which is that the Lyapunov exponent is a very convenient method for mathematicians and physicists to analyze the mixing dynamics in a flow field, either steady or time dependent. But it doesn't tell us very much about anything that can be tied to geochemical predictions. So it may be useful for one part of the community in this room, but not to everybody. So there's maybe a disconnect between this type of mixing analysis and something that that can actually be used to build insight into the chemistry of Earth's interior. Hopefully we can move on from that. And I'll mention just briefly another paper by Van Kaken and Zhang, 1999. So to put this in perspective, I think it was probably the second paper that used sitcom S, the finite element code for mantle flow modeling, when it first became available. And so these are kinematic models of flow in Earth's mantle. They were done in 3D spherical geometry, but this is the flat earther's view of how mantle convection works. And we've unwrapped it into a Cartesian box. And you can see selected particle pads. They show more in the paper, but I'm just showing you a couple of figures that I think are illustrative. And these particles are chosen to start at 2,000 kilometers depth. And what they're plotting is the trajectories that these particles take through the mantle under a flow field that's determined by the present-day plate motion. So they're imposing the plate motions at the surface. And it's not varying in time. So the particles are just being advected in a steady flow field. And you can see that in some regions, notably near the interiors of convection cells, the prediction from this geodynamic model is that the particles just take these fairly regular paths, looping through the mantle, just tracing out the pattern of large-scale convection in the mantle. In other regions, including actually some regions that are very close in space to where these points were selected, this is all the same flow field that the particles are being advected through, you can see actually far more chaotic trajectories. So these particles are jumping around back and forth. This is a Poincaré section. So it's a plot showing successive intersections of a flow path line with a horizontal surface, or in this case, a concentric spherical shell.
Question, Max. So you show a lot of mantle overturns in these particle paths. Were these computed from a static flow field, or did the model actually run for like
No, it's a static flow field. There's no time dependence in the flow.
Okay.
So the question is simply, what are the particle paths in the present-day mantle flow field? Obviously, we know plates are moving, plate boundaries are moving, and so the flow field in Earth's mantle is not static. So the relevance of this to mixing in Earth's mantle is not entirely straightforward, I guess, to establish. But it's still an important first step in understanding how things are going to move and disperse within the convecting mantle system. Other questions about this before we move on? OK, so the survival of any kind of heterogeneities in the interior is going to depend strongly on the viscosity structure. And so I want to tell you a little bit about what we know about the viscosity of Earth's mantle. And this is a picture, actually. I really like these wave-cut terraces. These are in Nunavut. And these wave-cut terraces record glacial isostatic adjustment over time. So these notches were cut during relative sea level high stands. And following glacial unloading, there's been elastic rebound, viscoelastic rebound of the surface here, exposing them above present-day sea level. And this is actually the foundation for the estimation of the viscosity of the upper mantle. So this is a super famous paper by Haskell from 1935 that was the first to make an estimate of the viscosity of Earth's mantle. And Haskell basically made a flat Earth approximation and used the solution for viscous flow in a half space underlain by a fluid of constant viscosity. And Haskell estimated the response time scale to glacial unloading, so removing a continental scale ice sheet, and made predictions of how quickly the surface elevation would recover over time. And what's remarkable about these predictions is that they're very close to what's still the present day accepted value for the viscosity of the mantle over the upper 1,200 kilometers or so, about 10 to the 21 Pascal seconds. It's kind of a fun paper. These old papers are usually really easy to read. And there's a really nice table giving viscosities of various other substances, including Shoemaker's wax, which I guess like had more relevance then than it does now. So from the analysis of postglacial rebound, Haskell came to a a value of about 10 to the 21 Pascal seconds. And that's actually very, very similar to what Jerry Mitrovica found in a 1996 reanalysis using a larger data set and a more sophisticated theoretical approach. Our constraints on I wanted to emphasize that this type of constraint on the viscosity structure informs mostly our understanding of the viscosity of the upper mantle. So on average, the viscosity of the top 1,200 kilometers or so, that's what Mitrovica 1996 showed. And in order to see deeper into the mantle, we typically look at the or model the geoid. So I'm going to play a movie now. This is the geoid as determined or measured by the GOCHE satellite from ESA. And you can see geoid undulations, highs and lows. And the geoid is the surface of gravitational equipotential. And we can model the geoid to try to understand something about the dynamics of Earth's interior. In order to do this, we have to delve into spherical harmonics. So it wouldn't be a geodynamics talk without a little bit of spherical harmonics. And what I'm showing you here are just the degree one and degree two spherical harmonics. So these are functions that form a complete, meaning you can represent any function on the surface of a sphere using them, an orthogonal basis, meaning that if you integrate the product of any one of these multiplied with another, you'll get zero. So they're in an orthogonal basis. You can decompose any function on the surface of the Earth using these spherical harmonics. And the degree one harmonics look like this. I've also cut off half of them that look like these, but rotated by 90 degrees divided by m, which is the angular order. And you can see that these degree one harmonics basically look like a positive anomaly on one side of the sphere, a negative anomaly on the opposing side. And there's one that looks like this with the positive anomaly at the North Pole and the negative at the South Pole, and another that looks like this with the positive and negative anomalies aligned to the equator of the sphere. The degree two spherical harmonics, the degree two mode zero has positive poles at the North and South Poles, so positive anomalies. It has a band of zero values at intermediate latitudes, and then a negative or, yeah, positive, depending on the sign of the coefficient that multiplies this thing at the equator. So it's polar and equatorial structure. And this one is very important geodynamically, which is the degree two harmonic, which looks kind of like a beach ball. It has nodes at the poles, and it has alternating maxima and minima along the equator. That looks an awful lot like this structure, lowermost mantle structure, which I'll come back to at the end of the talk, provided there's time. I sure hope so. And so this is lowermost mantle structure, which has strong overlap with this particular spherical harmonic, the degree 2-2 structure. I want to mention briefly that we also use spherical harmonics traditionally because they're fundamental solutions to the Laplace equation in spherical coordinates, and hence to many problems in gravity and viscous flow. So you can actually construct solutions to the Stokes equations for flow in Earth's interior using spherical harmonics. And that was the technique that was most used before we had powerful computers. It's also useful because these spherical harmonics represent signals at different wavelengths. So if you're looking for a method to filter a globally defined signal for long versus short wavelength structure, they provide a convenient basis for doing so, similar to Fourier analysis of signals. So these are plots, actually, of the long wavelength geoid. These are of the non-hydrostatic geoid, so I've subtracted the component that's associated with rotation. The rotational bulge contributes very strongly at spherical harmonic degree 2 and also has contributions at spherical harmonic degree 4. And these are the geoid for degree 2 through 4, so very long wavelength geoid, and for degrees 2 through 9. At shorter wavelengths. And it was demonstrated in the 1980s, this is a paper by Brad Hager, that the total geoid anomaly at the surface is the result of the combination of the gravitational influence of internal density anomalies. So if you have a positive density anomaly, it will exert a slight excess gravitational tug. But that density anomaly actually excites flow in the mantle. And so a positive density anomaly here, a net negative buoyancy anomaly, will drive a downwelling in the mantle. And that will also give rise to dynamic topography on the core mantle boundary and also at the surface. So there's surface deformation and core mantle boundary deformation. There's a very large density increase between the lower mantle and the outer core. So this downward deflection of the core mantle boundary indicated here will appear as a density deficit because you're replacing basically a volume of outer core material with higher density, with lower density mantle rock. The same goes for the surface. The surface is being deflected, and so you're going to see a density deficit at the surface. And so these all contribute to the gravitational potential, and depending on the relative amplitude of the internal density anomalies, the deflection of the bottom boundary and the deflection of the top boundary, you can produce different net geoid signals. So what's being shown here is the geoid anomaly associated with a unit density contrast for a model that has constant mantle viscosity, and on the right, a model that has a viscosity increase of a factor of 30 between the upper mantle and the lower mantle. And you can see that the total geoid anomaly here is the darkest of the lines. I'm sorry, it's a 1980s figure. And it's got a net negative geoid anomaly here, and here a net positive geoid anomaly. So the amplitude and sign of the geoid anomaly will depend on the details of the viscosity structure of the mantle, as well as the internal density structure. So we can use geodynamic models to predict these types of long wavelength geophysical observables. And doing so requires generally that we have some model for buoyancy structure within the mantle. And what I'm showing here is a figure from Ritsma et al. 2011 showing the shear wave velocity anomaly structure in a bunch of different then current global mantle tomography models. What I wanted you to take away from this is that these models have slightly different shear wave velocity structure, and they also have quite different shear wave velocity heterogeneity. So all of these models have been plotted with the same color scale, so -2% and +2%, and it's actually truncated here. Some of these models contain shear velocity variations that are significantly saturating the color scale. So in these different models, we have different shear velocity variations, and ultimately what we're going to do to build a model of flow in the mantle is to scale these shear velocity variations to variations in density, which contribute to buoyancy in the mantle. And doing so requires some understanding of the relationship between densities and shear velocities in the mantle. But before we even begin doing that, it's important to recognize that the amount of heterogeneity in these different models differs by quite a large amount. This is a figure from Boesky and Becker, 2002. This was the paper where they developed the S-mean average of tomographic models. And the quantity on the horizontal axis is the root mean squared velocity heterogeneity at a given depth. And shown are a slew of then current tomography models, as well as the mean tomography model S mean, which is this curve through here. And you can see that the variation in delta V RMS is more than a factor of 5 here. So if you were to predict buoyancy, mantle buoyancy, from these different tomography models that are shown, you might predict buoyancy values that differ quite significantly from one another.
So I should probably just point out,
Max,
if you go back to...
Wait, guy.
Sorry.
If you go back to...
Microphone.
If you go back... Is this on?
Yeah.
Just go back to that previous slide. I should point out
this one?
That from a historical perspective, you know, I lived through this.
Yeah.
And I can tell you that those early models that are all down on the far right side there are all wrong. Right? And you know, and now we've converged on the models on the left hand side, and that happened about the year 2000. Right, so it's a relatively old phenomenon. So this particular picture, I think, is very misleading about the current state. of disagreement between tomography models.
Okay, thank you for that guy.
At least shear velocity models.
But,
well, yeah, I mean, yeah. I'd like to also note that this has P-wave models, geodynamic models, and S-wave models.
Ah, right, right, yeah.
And so to echo what Guy just said, when you look at the modern S-wave models, their variations are much smaller than what you just quoted. So it's important, right? We expect S to have, you know, a factor 2 more power than P, but this particular plot makes a couple of other points as well.
Okay, thanks, Thorsten. So then typically we have to make some conversion between S velocity variations and density anomalies. And this is one example of how you might go about doing that. This is a set of curves of the ratio between d log rho and d log vs, so relative variations in density and relative variations in shear velocity. And these are predicted on the basis of thermodynamic calculations from Hephaesto, the code of Stixrud and Lithgow-Bertoloni. And this makes an assumption of constant composition through the mantle. So we're assuming a uniform pyrolytic mantle. And the three different curves shown on the left panel show you actually the ratio, this conversion factor, for different mantle potential temperatures. So these follow adiabatic paths through different mantle, adiabatic paths through the mantle with different potential temperatures, but all for the same choice of composition for 1300, 1600, and 1900 Kelvin. You can see there is some variation, a function of temperature, but generally in the lower mantle, the prediction from these models is that the ratio d log rho by d log vs is around 0.4. In the upper mantle, it's less. These funny wiggles in the transition zone are associated with phase boundaries.
Just a quick comment. For the students, d log something might be weird. Like what we mean there is a change in density over the density and the change in vs over the vs. And now we have a question.
So if you were to calculate a density anomaly in percent and a velocity anomaly in percent, this is the scaling factor between those two quantities.
Hey Max, I have a question. What's going on at 2600 for the 16 Kelvin?
At 2600, what's going on here? Okay, so this is actually the phase proportion for the same model, and I think this is Prem, this curve corresponding to shear wave velocity, and you can see that at this depth, 2600, this is post-perovskite.
But why don't you see that in the other geotherms?
So here's the 1600K, and you see this sharp spike, and you don't see it in the others. Lars or Carolina, can you comment on that?
I'd have to look at the numbers. it could be overlap of lines, but the post-perovskite transition should occur at different depths at different temperatures, so they actually shouldn't overlap completely.
So is this post-perovskite at 1300K? And this is post-perovskite at 1900K?
That's in the right direction, yes.
Yeah.
I think the yellow does have that spike.
Okay, that's a good question. Yeah, thanks. So what I'll say now is that now we calculate mantle flow using either propagator matrix technique or finite element models. I don't want to go down the technical road of explaining how these are done. But I think that was the purpose of the first geodynamics tutorial, to actually get some hands-on experience calculating mantle flow models using finite elements. And you'll get to do that a little bit more in the second geodynamics tutorial. But we can use one of basically two techniques to calculate the mantle flow field, the surface and core mantle boundary dynamic topography, and the geoid, given a distribution of densities within Earth's interior and some assumptions about the viscosity structure. We can calculate geoid kernels, and a geoid kernel tells you the geoid response to a unit change in density, a unit density anomaly, at a given spherical harmonic degree and at a given depth. And one of the reasons why this problem works so nicely is that if you put in a density anomaly with a given spherical harmonic degree and order structure, it will produce flow and geoid anomalies only at that same spherical harmonic degree and angular order. So we only have to calculate these geoid kernels for each spherical harmonic degree. The response of the angular orders is the same within a spherical harmonic degree. And you can see these geoid kernels here for different mantle density structures, just as n-member limits. What I'm showing you here are the kernels for a uniform viscosity mantle and for a mantle with a viscosity of 100. And the key thing to note here is that when you introduce a viscosity contrast within the mantle, the sign of the geoid kernel changes between the upper mantle and the lower mantle. So here we have a positive geoid kernel in the upper mantle and a negative geoid kernel in the lower mantle. These different colors correspond to different assumptions about the details of the viscosity structure. Some of them have a viscosity increase at the 660, and some of them place it somewhat deeper at 1,000 kilometers. But all have this general behavior that when you introduce a change in the viscosity at the transition zone, you'll change the sign of the geoid kernel. And the reason that this improves the fit with the geoid is that the overall correlation between the geoid and the mantle shear velocity anomaly structure changes as a function of depth. So this plot shows the correlation between the average tomography model, S-mean 2, which is an update of the S-mean model from Boesky and Becker, 2002. And we show here the correlation between S-mean 2 and the geoid for different spherical harmonic degrees between 2 and 7. So this plot on the right shows you spherical harmonic degree versus depth, and the color scale tells you the correlation between the VS structure and the geoid. So you can see that correlations are generally positive in the upper mantle, generally negative in the lower mantle, and this is the net correlation for the degrees that are shown at the right. So you can see that you go from a positive correlation around 0.5 in the upper mantle to a negative correlation in the lower mantle, and there's a zero crossing somewhere in kind of the shallow upper mantle, somewhere around 1,000 kilometers depth. So you're going from positive correlation to negative correlation with the geoid. Going back to the previous figure, if you want to fit the geoid really well, what you want to do is maximize the overlap with the positive part of the geoid kernel in the upper mantle, and then maximize the overlap with the negative part of the geoid kernel in the lower mantle. And by multiplying a negative geoid kernel with a negative density anomaly, you'll produce a positive correlation between the geoid and density. Lejeune?
When you say the correlation between the geoid and S-mean, are you talking about a particular viscosity structure you're using, or what?
No. There's no need to assume anything about the viscosity structure. So I've just taken the geoid, and I've expanded it out into spherical harmonics, and I've also expanded a mantle tomography model into spherical harmonics at each depth. And I'm just calculating at each spherical harmonic degree the correlation between the spherical harmonic coefficients for the geoid and the spherical harmonic coefficients for the VS structure.
So positive geoid versus fast anomaly, or the other way?
Positive geoid, yes. Positive geoid versus positive VS. Negative. Hold on.
No. So fast is positive, fast is cold, cold is dense, fast and dense, dense is high, right? So that's, you don't have to put any minus signs there. In the lower mantle, we have a geoid high on top of slow VS anomalies, right? And so then you have a negative correlation.
Thank you, Ved. So I'll also mention briefly that this type of analysis works because the geoid at long wavelengths is relatively insensitive to lateral variations in viscosity. So we can assume just a depth-dependent profile of viscosity and calculate these types of geoid kernels, which do not account in any way for lateral viscosity variations. But to first approximation, solutions that include lateral viscosity variations, shown here on the right, are very, very similar to the solutions that don't include lateral viscosity variations. So we can make this theoretical simplification in fitting the geoid. In the interest of time, we're really running low on time, so I'm just going to skip some stuff. I'll mention that we've done this, and one of the reasons I brought this up is that it was actually a CIDR project from CIDR 4 years ago to estimate the viscosity structure. And these are models that are kind of an update of the models that we did at that CIDR. And you can see that we find some evidence for stronger lithosphere, weaker upper mantle, and an increase in viscosity below the transition zone, so at a depth of about 1,000 kilometers, a mid-mantle viscosity high, and then a decrease in the viscosity. So these are using actually SEM-UCB WM1 to infer lateral variations in VS and converting it to density variations using those conversion factors from Hephaesto that I showed you. From joint models of glacial isostatic adjustment and modeling the geoid, many other workers have estimated the viscosity profile. And I'll just say briefly, this is from one of Dick Peltier's papers in the upper right. And you can see in this model a weak, relatively weak upper mantle, an increase in viscosity at the 660 and a subsequent increase in viscosity in the shallow upper mantle. Similar features are seen in King and Masters, 1992. Which is constrained only by the geoid. So one of the things that I forgot to mention is the geoid is sensitive only to relative variations in the viscosity, not the absolute viscosity. So in order to constrain the absolute viscosity, you need to combine glacial isostatic adjustment and fitting the geoid. This only uses the geoid, so you just see some normalized viscosity. That's the same thing that we show here. Let's get to some implications of this. If there are questions, we can come back to this kind of stuff. My computer's totally frozen, so we're just stuck looking to this until it moves on. But so how do depth variations in viscosity affect mixing? I'll just summarize work from a couple of different papers. By no means exhaustive, as there's an extensive literature on this topic. But this is an early paper from Gurness and Davies, 1986. And what's being shown here are some numerical calculations of mantle flow and the dispersal of tracers that were initially arranged in a uniform basal layer. These are passive tracers, so there's no density difference between the tracers and the ambient mantle. And what's being varied here is a power law exponent that's called beta in this equation. This equation gives the depth dependence of viscosity, and viscosity increases according to this power law with respect to depth. So it's not a discontinuity in viscosity at the 660 like the models that I just showed you, but it's an exponential increase in viscosity with depth. And what they found in these different cases, so first of all, the quantity that's shown here, 0, 6, 11, and 23, it's a measure of time. And the way time is measured here is using an overturn time. And a transit time here is around 60 million years. So this model, Model C, which had the largest viscosity variations, was run out to 300 overturn times. This model, Model A, which has uniform viscosity, was run only to 23 overturn times. The takeaway message here is that you basically get fairly efficient mixing of this tracer throughout the mantle, as you might expect when viscosity is uniform. And as you increase the depth variation of viscosity, you can increasingly start to preserve some of that basal high viscosity material. Here's another paper. This one is by John Nalaboff and Louise Kellogg from 2007. And this one is a little bit more complicated because in addition to varying viscosity with depth, these are actually different viscosity profiles. They simultaneously varied thermal conductivity because at the time, there were some very provocative suggestions that there was a large increase in thermal conductivity in the lower mantle due to radiative effects on thermal conductivity. So they're co-varying both viscosity and thermal conductivity. So in a way, it's not entirely a fair comparison with the previous study. But nevertheless, these are depictions, actually, of the position of the particles after 2 billion years and after 4 billion years. In these different models, they seeded all of the particles in the lower left quadrant. And you can see the thermal structure in the flow field here. So there's a single downwelling in the middle of the domain, and a basal layer that becomes kind of increasingly sluggish and hot as you increase the viscosity ratio. And I just want to point out that the viscosity in the top part of the model is the same in all of these. And what's kind of interesting here, actually, is that as you increase the viscosity ratio between the top and bottom parts of the domain, there's not a monotonic trend in how these particles get dispersed. So here, actually, in this intermediate state with about a 50-fold viscosity increase, you can see large unmixed regions that none of these tracer particles ever get mixed into, even after 4 billion years. But as you go to a larger viscosity contrast, you actually see more efficient kind of homogenization of that lower left quadrant material into the entire mantle domain. This is maybe a little bit unexpected, but the reason given is that when you make the viscosity contrast larger, the flow in this lower part of the domain is more sluggish. So you're releasing material into the upper domain where it's being mixed much more effectively laterally. And then as it's stirred back into the bottom, more viscous layer, because it's been homogenized already in the top, it ends up better mixed into the bottom part of the domain. Any questions about this idea? Lars.
I'm wondering how to quantify mixing. The panel in the bottom right certainly looks well mixed. But then I'm also thinking of volcanoes, which is how we sample this field. And volcanoes are small, and they might even be sub-grid scale. So how do we quantify this?
That's an excellent question, and I think it's something that everybody has struggled with. You could assume that volcanoes sample a random mixture of this, or some volcanoes could sample only a single kind of unmixed domain. Ultimately, mixing has to occur at a much smaller scale than even the tracer particles in these types of models. So I'm not sure actually that on a one volcano scale, you can really address that question with this type of model. Yeah.
Can you clarify the model? I mean, I'm not quite sure why there's a downwelling always in the center. Is that imposed on the surface, or
I don't remember what the surface boundary conditions were.
Because that's presumably important, right?
For the mixing. Yeah. In the previous study, there are prescribed surface boundary conditions, so there's some plate-like flow prescribed at the surface. I don't remember. Louise isn't here, I guess, but I don't remember actually what boundary conditions they imposed at the surface.
Max.
Yeah.
So last week, Sujoy had showed some results of, I don't remember what the convection model was, but they'd done some random sampling, and then they tried to map it out in some isotope space.
So was that the Brandenburg et al. 2008 paper?
I thought that the gist of that particular study was that the models were like too mixed, or they couldn't explain all of the observations, the volcanic observations. So like it. Do I remember?
I don't remember well enough. I'm sorry. Maybe Sujoy can comment if it was stemming from Sujoy's talk, or maybe like in the interest of time, we should move on.
We can move on.
We're on slide 42 of 76, okay? So I'll talk now briefly about primitive blobs. Maybe you'll have as many questions about these as everything else. But here's a cartoon of large primitive blobs distributed through the mantle. And briefly, viscous blobs might survive mantle stirring. This is a paper by Michael Manga from 1996, where he introduced, in this case, five viscous blobs with a viscosity an order of magnitude higher than the ambient mantle. And in this case, a configuration of nine blobs, slightly smaller blobs, but in a closer packed configuration. And the configuration of the flow field here, it's a steady flow field, not time varying. And there's just an imposed plate motion to the right. So it's a model for the kind of large scale flow, something representative of what you might see in a single convection cell. And over 1,800 million years, so 1.8 billion years of dimensional time, you can see that in this case, the five blobs get stirred around, they interact with each other. One of them gets stretched out into a more like a tendril shape. These two blobs actually start to merge. So there's interaction between the blobs. You can actually kind of agglomerate these blobs onto one another, but they can persist on timescales of billions of years. This was explored in more detail in a paper by Torsten Becker and others from 1999, where they, I wanted to say also in this model, the blobs are more viscous than the ambient mantle, but they have no net buoyancy. So there's no thermal convection here. It's a purely kinematic flow. And ultimately, the stability of these blobs would depend on the viscosity contrast between the blobs and the ambient mantle, which in turn depends on the temperature of the blobs, something that was considered in more detail in this paper. So they looked at the heating of the blobs, assuming conductive heating and internal heat production, and thought a bit about how the viscosity contrast between the blobs and the ambient mantle could be maintained. And a related model is actually the BEAMS model from Balmer et al. 2016. This is a very provocative model that was proposed now.
It was actually 2017.
Oh, shoot. I'm sorry about that. Well, this is a very provocative model. And okay, in the BEAMS model, this is the first, I must have gotten a submission date or something. I pulled this out of Nature Geoscience. Yeah, I apologize. So let's see. So what's being shown here is mantle potential temperature in the first panel and composition. And this is in a model with no BEAMS. BEAMS stands for Bridgmanite Enriched Ancient Mantle Structures. And the essence of the idea is that there's a variation in the ratio of magnesium to silicon. And that compositional variation can lead to viscosity differences. And the viscosity differences can lead to the preservation of large-scale coherent structures that would be located within the mid-mantle. So here are the BEAMS, these lighter kind of pink-colored blobs, which are separate from downwellings. And they reside in the centers of convection cells. And in these models, they can persist over long timescales, exchanging minimal material with the ambient mantle. I think we'll probably get to hear more about this, so I won't say any more. But this is one idea for how you can maintain over long timescales large variations in composition within the mantle. And that's in quite a bit of contrast to the models with just purely depth-dependent viscosity that I showed you previously. So in all the models with just depth variation of viscosity, with no contribution from chemical buoyancy, you actually tend to mix the mantle and destroy all that heterogeneity relatively quickly. But actually having very large scale, high viscosity domains in the mantle might be a good mechanism through which to preserve these types of chemical variations. The biggest problem with this type of idea is heat production. If these become significantly hotter through radiogenic heat production than the ambient mantle, their viscosity will decrease. If you assume, say, 50 Kelvin temperature increase would lead to an order of magnitude viscosity decrease, then even if they start two orders of magnitude more viscous than the ambient mantle, over 200 million years, if they can't cool efficiently, they'll reduce viscosity to ambient mantle viscosity and then be very rapidly mixed in. Christine? Yeah.
I would say one of the differences in this too is instead of trying to put small features in and then hide them, we're actually implying that the ambient mantle is this highly viscous stuff. So it's a little bit different way of thinking about it.
Yeah, okay, thank you. Okay, so the biggest problem I think is heat production, but there are ways that you could argue for reduced heat production within the beams. And if you can do that, then maybe they're even more stable on long time scales. Okay, so let's talk about these last couple classes of models in which there's some kind of primitive reservoir at the base of the mantle, possibly a reservoir containing high helium-3 relative to helium-4. Helium-3 is the primordial isotope of helium. helium-4 is produced over time through radioactive decay, so it's radiogenic. And I'll kind of address both of these models simultaneously in the context of LLSVPs. The LLSVPs have come up, I think, a little bit during week one of CIDR. This is a map, the VOAT map, or cluster map, of lower mantle structure from Lekic et al. 2012 on the left. And they clustered velocity profiles through five different mantle tomography models. And the red regions, these large, broad, slow regions, actually, are where all five models agree that seismic velocities are slow, or that velocity profiles are similar in their prediction of slow velocities. And on the right is a simpler analysis. This is a figure showing an isosurface in the tomography model S20RTS, the figure I took out of Alan McNamara's 2018 tectonic physics paper. But this is the negative 0.6% slow anomaly in S20RTS. There's no particular significance of that particular choice of velocity anomaly, but it does define pretty nicely these kind of pile structures in the lower mantle beneath Africa here and beneath the Pacific. And they have similar morphology, you can see in this divergent color scale, to the blobs that are imaged in Vedlakic's work. The LLSVPs are also associated with the locations of present-day hotspots, and it's been suggested that the boundaries of the LLSVPs are associated with the locations of large igneous provinces. So this is a figure from a paper by Torsvik et al. 2010. And what they've done in this figure is to reconstruct, by kind of winding backwards, plate motions, the locations of large igneous provinces, flood basalt provinces, when they erupted. And you can see that when they do this, you actually see that they all, almost all, except for Columbia River basalt, plot near the margins of the LLSVPs. And these large igneous provinces were emplaced between 15 and 297 million years ago. And as a result, they argue that this is evidence that the LLSVPs have remained essentially fixed over that period of geologic time, which is truly remarkable. They also show kimberlites, actually a subset of a global kimberlite database. And some of the kimberlites also seem to lie, diamond-bearing kimberlites in particular, around the margins of the African LLSVP. Though there are actually some other kimberlites, like up in Canada and within the US, that are nowhere near the LLSVP boundaries. So this is actually really important, this question of whether the LLSVPs represent chemical heterogeneity in the deep mantle and whether they've moved over time. I'll just say briefly one of the reasons why they, why it's important to understand whether they've moved over time is to inform plate reconstructions for Earth's distant past. And if you assume that the LIPs have, the LLSVPs have remained fixed over long periods of time, then you can associate large igneous provinces that can't be linked to their present-day locations through plate circuits to the location, the paleo longitude at which they were emplaced. So we can get the paleo latitude from PaleoMag, and then you can assume that Umayshan, for instance, emplaced 258 million years ago, was emplaced at either the boundary of the Pacific LLSVP or at the margin of the African LLSVP. So this type of approach is actually being used to extend plate reconstructions farther back in time. So it's important to understand whether it's built on a firm foundation in the sense that the LLSVPs have remained fixed or maybe whether they've moved, and to understand how much they might have moved over time. I'll mention a little bit lines of evidence for the compositional distinctness of the LLSVPs. I just want to say briefly, this is a paper from Mulick and Ekstrom, 2016, that shows different models for the lower mantle density and shear velocity anomaly structure. And on the left is a model that better fits the normal mode constraints on lowermost mantle density structure. On the right is a model that remains more correlated with the lowermost mantle shear velocity anomaly structure. And the point here is that you can better fit the data by including a slight compositional, presumably compositional density excess that's aligned with the Pacific hemisphere and with Africa, where the African LLSVP is. That fits slightly better than this density model, which has a density low, so more consistent with the thermal origin of the LLSVPs on the right. There's also a very intriguing paper by Harriet Lau and others in 2017 that uses tidal tomography, so looking at the solid Earth tidal response of the entire Earth and modeling the density structure in the lowermost mantle. What they've done here is actually started by assuming that the density structure was correlated with the shear velocity structure. So they can't constrain the entire nature of the lowermost mantle density structure, but if they assume that the density structure mirrors the shear velocity structure, then they can fairly robustly estimate the density excess within the lowermost mantle. And they find some evidence that the very lowermost mantle might have a slight density excess, around 0.5% density anomaly. And this can really only be explained through some kind of compositional variation of density, because we know shear velocities are slow. So if we were to just convert shear velocities into densities, we would expect a net low density anomaly. But instead, we see actually from the tidal response and from normal mode analyses, a slight density excess. So if this is a dense layer at the base of the mantle, it's important to understand the requirements for its stability and how it might evolve over time. I'm going to judiciously skip slides here, so I apologize to anybody whose work gets skipped. But I want to first define this important concept of a buoyancy number, which is how we characterize the stability of a dense chemical layer at the base of the mantle. The buoyancy number is just the ratio of the compositional density difference to the density differences arising from thermal expansion. So if we were to estimate this for the mantle, we'd use the density difference between the ambient lower mantle and the LLSVP material, a representative thermal expansivity reference density, and the temperature difference driving convection. And depending on the value of the buoyancy ratio B and the amount of a compositionally dense layer that you have, you can get quite different and interesting dynamics. I won't say much more than that about it, except that the larger the buoyancy number is, the more stable a basal compositionally distinct layer will be. So increasing buoyancy ratio will increase the stability of the LLSVP material. So what controls the shape of the lowermost mantle structures? Well, this goes back to modeling that was done in the early 90s by Yannick Ricard and others, and then by Carolina Lithgow-Bertoloni and others. This is just a very simple model for how mantle density heterogeneity evolves. And they're dropping slablets, so little bits of slabs in 5 million year increments into the mantle, and just letting them sink vertically at a rate that's determined basically by Stokes settling. And when you make this very physically simplified set of assumptions about how mantle density structure evolves, you predict basically the shape of downwellings in the mantle. You can build a slab model by doing this. And I just want to point out briefly that you see a different slope of these things in the upper mantle versus the lower mantle. And you also see some net deflection, and that's entirely associated with trench migration here. So the location on the surface where these slablets are being dropped into the mantle is marching to the right over time. And these things are sinking into the mantle, and they're settling more slowly through the lower mantle than through the upper mantle, which is what gives rise to this different slope below the 660. Okay. Well, let's just skip all the way to the end and just say people have performed these types of more sophisticated calculations with a compositionally dense layer at the base of the mantle. And they've shown that when you impose plate motions at the surface, realistic subduction histories, you can explain basically the morphology of the present-day LLSVPs contingent on some assumptions about the mechanical behavior of the chemically dense material that you introduce, for instance, the viscosity contrast with respect to the ambient lower mantle. And there's a really important prediction, I think, that the lowermost mantle structure changes over time. So as a consequence of the changing locations of subduction zones in particular, subducting oceanic lithosphere sinks to the core mantle boundary and pushes aside any compositionally distinct material in the lowermost mantle, organizing it into distinct piles. This is from a paper by Nan Zhang. And over the past 458 million years, the prediction from this type of modeling is that there's a large-scale reorganization of any kind of compositionally distinct material, shown in red here. It's actually the temperature field, but the red regions are all occupied by the compositionally dense material. And it's basically rearranged due to tectonic history from basically a degree one structure, one big pile, into two distinct piles. And there's very strong correlation between this predicted structure and the observed structure, though it doesn't quite agree in detail. So these types of models have shown basically that a dense, compositionally distinct layer at the base of the mantle can persist on long timescales. In the case of these simulations, kind of 450 to 600 million years, if you include spin-up, there's always some entrainment of this material. Entrainment is numerically unavoidable, but it also is seen in lab experiments with miscible fluids. But the general concept of the persistence of these large domains, large compositionally distinct domains in the lower mantle, is certainly feasible. Insofar as geodynamical models can provide some constraints on that. So I want to end by providing a brief preview of what we can do during the next tutorial. This is actually a snapshot from a two-dimensional geodynamic model with a compositionally distinct layer at the base of the mantle. And we can actually start to do things like a mixing analysis, calculating the finite time Lyapunov exponent for this field, or maybe others that you might be interested in with different distributions of mantle heterogeneity. Okay?
So if the LLSVPs are being pushed around on the timescale of a couple hundred million years, can you still reconcile that with having your lips around the edges of those?
Yeah, actually, we have some work on this that hasn't been published. But we demonstrated that the correlation between moving lips predicted from geodynamic models and the correlation between static lips is indistinguishable.
Indistinguishably good?
Well, yeah, it's been argued actually that the correlation with the static piles is very good. Torsten, do you have a comment on that? There's actually a very
why is that, and does it mean that this whole exercise is meaningless, or does it mean they're just moving back and forth so that on average they can provide a longitudinal reference frame?
Okay. Basically, the reason that that's true is that the distribution of lips in time is highly non-uniform. And most of the lips happen during a time period when all of the geodynamic models that we ran predict that the configuration of the basal layer is very similar to the present-day configuration. So the basal layer is being reconfigured, but the large-scale division of the LLSVP material predicted from the kinds of models that Shiji Zhang's group has developed occurs around 180 million years. And that's older than almost all of the lips. So you form two distinct piles prior to most of the lip volcanism. We can talk about it more.